You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Blind and partially sighted people can experience various barriers to sex education. They may face stigma or come up against unhelpful misconceptions when seeking information, and biology and sexual health classes rarely have accessible resources or tactile models. We're joined today by Director of Sex Ed Matters, Laura Corrington, MBE, and facilitator, Georgia Bondi, to learn more about making sex education more accessible and inclusive for people with sight loss. Hi, Laura and Georgia. Thanks so much for joining us. So can we start with a bit of background about Sex Ed Matters? What is the organisation and why was it founded?
So Sex Ed Matters is an organisation dedicated to making confidence building sex education as accessible as possible for people across the UK. We started in 2019, just before the new sex ed curriculum came into place. And we basically were born out of being really inspired by the new curriculum, which was the first time the sex ed curriculum was updated in 20 years. And it just includes so many topics that I really wish I'd had access to when I was at school. And I know a lot of other people feel the same way. After it came out for the first time ever, schools had to teach topics like consent, like dealing with rejection, friendship, all of these really central experiences of sex and relationships that were never part of the curriculum because the curriculum previously was very focused on biology, which obviously isn't really the reality of sex and relationships. So yeah, we're really excited to kind of explore how we can deliver this to as many different communities as possible in the most effective ways. This year, we've won some funding from UKRI to create a platform to help young people speak up about the best ways they can access sex ed and what kind of problems they're facing on the ground in schools. So yeah, we're hoping that will bring us with a lot of data about what more needs to be done in this field.
And what are some of the barriers to sex education that blind and partially sighted people might face?
The barriers for blind and partially sighted people are also kind of barriers for mainstream audiences. And it all boils down, in my opinion at least, to the fact that sex education has traditionally been so focused on biology and has been quite visual in that biology. So when we think about sex ed, we might think about the different images of STIs that we got, you know, taught at school and what these look like, but it cuts people out who can't visually see those images. But also the images of the models are usually white and usually male, and we don't necessarily see what the variety looks like in reality of different STIs. And in any case, a lot of STIs don't have any symptoms. So it's really unhelpful, basically, to boil sex ed down to biology and then boil it down even further to visualizing that biology. And yet that's kind of just how we've done it for so many generations, partly because of the stigma attached to it. There's lots and lots of studies, especially from the USA, to show that, you know, of course, blind and partially sighted people are just as sexually active as anyone else, and yet they have less access to information about sexual health. And it's interesting that a lot of the research is really about sexual health and reproductive health, but it's not necessarily talking about education about consent. And, you know, as I said before, all of these other topics that are arguably just as important. And, you know, we need to talk about all of these things to reflect the reality of the whole issue, which is sex and relationships.
Apart from my facilitator hat, I am also researching disability in general and sexuality, particularly sexual pleasure. And the statistics for sex ed for disabled people, including, of course, blind and partially sighted people, is pretty terrible. They're much more statistically likely to have not received any sex ed from their parents at home, much more likely to have been excluded in the classroom because of accessibility barriers, because teachers feel embarrassed to actually talk about sex explicitly. So they fall back on diagrams of ovaries and, you know, a pack of condoms on the table where they kind of vaguely point at it. Definitely stigma gets in the way.
There's a very unhelpful misconception, as you said, that blind and partially sighted people and disabled people in general have less desire to have sex, or on the other end, sort of hypersexualization just due to people being blind and partially sighted. What kind of effect can that have on, you know, blind and partially sighted people living their lives just wanting to get information and build their own idea of themselves as, you know, sexual people having intimate relationships?
In my mind, I kind of split it into two halves: the way a person feels about themselves and the way other people tend to treat them. I find that when you grow up in an environment where your own sexuality is treated as non-existent, it's really hard for you to model what kind of sexuality you might enjoy, what kind of sex life you're looking for, because the overwhelming narrative has been that it doesn't exist. And we know that, for example, in, let's say, LGBTQIA plus people, the more people see themselves represented, the more likely they are to be able to say, oh, wait, maybe I'm bisexual, maybe I'm asexual. And I think it's the same with disabled people and with blind and partially sighted people in particular. Without a sort of cultural understanding that we have sexual desire too, it's really hard to understand that about yourself. And on the flip side, if most of the people who you would like to date think that you aren't a sexual being, then they are not likely to pursue you. And if you pursue them, they are perhaps less likely to say yes, because they've heard this over and over that you are not a sexual being. And that is a terrible, terrible judgment to have placed on a person, because it means that you are then less likely to have a fulfilling sex life, have fulfilling relationships, just because of those misconceptions. And that is a horrible position to be in as a person.
Yeah, if you have to confront all of these misconceptions every single time you express a normal desire, then it must be really difficult not to carry feelings of shame around that.
For sure. It can be really difficult to overcome that in terms of your self-image. If you feel shame about your own sexuality, having the confidence to let somebody see you in a sexual way can be really, really tricky. That shame can be really pervasive.
And there's a general lack of representation of blind and partially sighted people in media. Why do we need more representations of blind and partially sighted people in romantic and sexual relationships?
Right now, the representation we have is one of two flavours. It's either you're a sob story, like somebody becomes blind in a TV show and it's the worst thing that happened ever, and you don't get to see any kind of normal life lived, or the disabled person is the villain in the story. If we think about all those superhero films where disabled people have rage about being disabled and end up being the villain. And when those are your only bits of representation, what chance do you have for seeing yourself do all the kinds of things that other people get to see done in films? That's can be anything from having a successful career to having a romantic relationship that feels really fulfilling. Pretty much all parts of life fail to be represented. That leads to really terrible self-image, and it's really difficult to then plan your life around, like, what kinds of things do you want if you don't know what they are, because you've not seen them done in a body like yours. It's really tricky. And when you have proper representation, you have the opposite. You have so many options represented for the kinds of relationship you might have, that intersection there between perhaps being blind and partially sighted and LGBTQIA+. If you saw a character with a specific sexuality who is also blind and partially sighted, then perhaps you can begin to consider your own sexuality or your own gender or your own, you know, romantic relationships. It's so heartwarming when you get to see yourself represented after so long seeing yourself not represented at all.
How does audio description in media impact sex education? Because if there's no audio description for sex and romantic scenes, or it's bad and doesn't really give a sense of what's happening, that's informal sex education people are missing out on too.
For sure. I think that includes social media. There is a big push from a lot of people on social media to make sure if they have images, there is an image description, but not everybody does it. So when you have these really amazing sex educators online who are providing really useful information that perhaps they're not getting in school, you end up with a case where people are disproportionately not educated when they're blind or partially sighted, and they can't access some of those really great online resources, which is just a terrible waste because it takes so little time. There could be lots done by individual online educators in that regard.
And people we talk to sometimes get asked how they know if they're attracted to people that they can't see. What would you say kind of about that and the ways that people can be attracted to non-visual elements of their partners?
From a sex education perspective, that's such an interesting question, because sex ed we get through TV and film essentially is, what does attraction look like? Oh, it's always how somebody looks, or, you know, if they're my type, or judging people on their appearance and judging their sexiness purely on their appearance is just what we see in TV and film for so long, and have seen for so long. And that's really where a lot of consent problems come from, and a lot of like relationship understandings of what a relationship is come from for everyone, and particularly blocks blind and partially sighted people out of the whole conversation about sexuality, like Georgia was saying earlier. So yeah, the more we can move away from that as a society, the better for everybody. Of course, there's so much that you find attractive about someone that's not anything to do with their visual appearance whatsoever.
I agree. This is one of those things where it's, if society as a whole could change the way we were looking at this, it would be generally more inclusive of blind and partially sighted people. So I think there's a lot to be learned from the LGBTQIA plus community in this regard, because with the exploration of the difference between romantic and sexual attraction, we really start to break down, well, what is it exactly that we mean when we say we're sexually attracted to somebody? So let's say you feel romantically attracted to a certain person, as in like you want to, you know, take them on nice dates. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are sexually attracted to them. And perhaps for you, one of those things does come with visuals and the other one doesn't. I think when most people really start to allow themselves to just like whoever they like, they may find it has nothing to do with the visuals. Or maybe it started with some visuals and then did somewhere else. So we know that sexuality exists on this vast spectrum of when somebody feels sexually attracted, when somebody feels romantically attracted. And this idea of it's just like boom when you see a long pair of legs is so strange, and maybe an excellent visual in a Hollywood film, but probably doesn't represent life particularly well.
And it's so in keeping, isn't it, with, you know, traditional fairy tales or notions of love that have really have a lot of misogynistic undertones to them as well, in terms of, you know, the typical narrative of a beautiful woman will be asleep or whatever and she'll be seen by a man. That's a very typical narrative, who will come in and decide to snatch her or pursue her or take her in some way. And, you know, that very basic concept of love is just what we're taught from such a young age, and it's so problematic for so many reasons. You know, one of them being overly emphasizes the visual elements of it.
Absolutely. And the general public conversation around establishing consent is ever growing and ever changing. How are blind and partially sighted people impacted by changes in that discussion?
I love this question, because I actually think that the way consent should be done, it wouldn't be any different for blind and partially sighted people. Consent is about two individuals communicating clearly and enthusiastically with each other. So if you are communicating something to a blind or partially sighted person who you want to have sex with, and it's not clear to them, then it's not consent. So if you're doing consent properly, you should understand the person you're with, understand what clear communication of consent would look like for them. So in this case, it might be verbal, and to know what enthusiastic consent looks like in return. So in the case of a blind or partially sighted person, again, that may be verbal for that particular person. Unfortunately, we live in a culture where often people like to avoid verbal consent. They like to go with visual cues, for lots of different reasons. Sometimes people think it's romantic to just dive in for a kiss. But of course, that disproportionately affects somebody who's blind or partially sighted, because if somebody dives at you for a kiss without asking, if you are a sighted person, you can say no because you can see it coming. But if you're blind or partially sighted, you've been given even less of a choice. But I personally am a great believer in being really, really clear about how you wish to interact with somebody else's body, because you want to make sure they are as excited as you are about receiving that contact.
We always go into schools and teach that consent is an enthusiastic yes. That's the case for everyone, although enthusiasm could look different in different people. We talk about that a lot. You know, what does enthusiasm, what does that mean? Like, what does it feel like for yourself, and how does it look in all its different forms? And in terms of the law, of course, consent is giving someone the freedom and capacity to make a choice.
body language is a really lovely thing to have. And body language can, of course, be sensed through touch as well as through sight. But it's not consent. I think at the end of the day, someone looking a certain way is not consent. So actually, there's a lot to be learned from blind and partially sighted people and disabled people in general. And that's also something I've been finding in my research, that disabled communities tend to have really improved communication regarding sex and consent, just because you may need to do things slightly differently. So there's no assumption made about what you can and can't do with your body, because you might need to explain it to a partner. So there's so much to be learned from disabled people about consent and about how to negotiate consent.
And in our romantic relationship roundtable, the panelists mentioned sometimes finding consensual touch difficult because they've received a lot of unwanted touch from strangers trying to lead them across the road or touching them in other unsolicited ways. How can people talk about that and make sure they're comfortable if they're struggling with it in a consensual relationship?
I can give a personal answer. I have a visual impairment, but it doesn't really affect my sex life particularly. But I do have other disabilities that require me to negotiate with my partner. And I do have other disabilities that mean that there have been times in my life where my own bodily autonomy has not been respected. And that's the case for a lot of disabled people. And women in this world, unfortunately, are disproportionately affected by people not respecting bodily autonomy. I think it's a really good idea to firstly be sleeping with somebody who you trust completely. If you can't trust them to have the conversation about this, then probably you shouldn't be sleeping with them. Once you have established that you do trust them with this part of you, I think firstly letting them know that you may have some sexual trauma, or you may have some trauma around non-consensual touch, and really negotiating with them what that might look like. And it's going to be a really personal thing, right? So for me, it looks like I do not like to be touched in a crowd behind me. That makes me panic. So that's really specific to me, right? Like, don't touch me when we're in a crowd and you're standing behind me. And that's something I had to learn over time myself. And sometimes it makes sense to write these things down, to like keep a note of things. Like when a touch doesn't feel good, write it down, make a note for yourself, and communicate these things to your partners. Communicate how you do like to be touched, how you do like to be asked. I am a big fan of the "can I kiss you?" I know some people find that terribly unromantic, but to me, it just really affirms that they respect my yes and my no. And I think that's very, very sexy. So I think it's really individual. And you kind of have to learn about yourself to be able to communicate these things to your partner. And once you have, and it will probably be ad hoc and over time, you can openly talk about these things as you go. It's going to be a learning experience.
Sometimes these feelings can, of course, like change over time as well. So not to feel worried if, you know, you feel different about physical touch in different contexts over your lifetime, and just keeping your partner up to date with that and how it's changing and how your feelings are changing over time is completely normal and completely fine. Being open and honest about it, or as open and honest as you can be, is important throughout.
And for people who want to learn more about sex ed matters and access some of the sex education resources you have, where can they go?
Yeah, so you can go to sexedmatters.co.uk. We're also on all socials, sexedmattersuk. Most of our work at the moment is focused on the workshops that we're doing in terms of the resources as well. So those workshops are, you're done in person, very much kind of tailored to the audience. We work with a few special educational needs schools that include blind and partially sighted people. And, you know, we make sure that everything is accessible in our workshops. And we're always up for more feedback as well from different audiences. And yeah, if you want any more information at all, you could always email me. My email address is info@sexedmatters.co.uk. And the next couple of years will be really exciting for us. We're bringing out, as I said before, a platform that will help young people speak up about the kind of sex ed problems they might be facing, from sexting to speaking to their parents about sex ed. And yeah, they'll be able to tell us through this platform, and we're making sure that it's all accessible as possible. So there'll be a button to press and everything will turn, you know, more easy to see colours, and you can increase the size of the font, and you can click a button as well, and there'll be audio, you know, somebody actually speaking the questions out to you as well. So we've been working with a few organizations to try and make that as successful as possible. So really looking forward to that. And we're also hopefully going to be working on a podcast as well about navigating the realities of sex and relationships, especially for underrepresented demographics. So yeah, keep an eye on us the next couple of years. Hopefully, you'll be seeing those updates as well. And Georgia, I don't know if you want to give a shout out to where people can find out more about your research.
So yes, you can find me and bits and bobs about my research on my Instagram, which is It Is My Body. It also has some of my pole dance performance work on there and bits and bobs about sexuality as well.
Well, thank you so much, Laura Corryton, MBE, and Georgia Bondi, for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.